You're listening to The Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, otherwise known as The Lamb. The Lamb is the world's biggest collection of online movie blogs, and every week on this show we invite various Lamb members on to talk about pretty much everything in our movie-loving worlds. Find The Lambcast at largeassmovieblogs.com. Hello everybody, and welcome to episode 466 of the Lambcast. I'm your host, Jake Lewitt, a man so negative I'm known in some parts as Dr. No. And this week, we're kicking off the first in a series of shows that will tackle the Bond franchise. It's something we've been meaning to do on the Lambcast for a very long time. And it's been a bit... We haven't done it yet, because it's quite a daunting topic, and every few years it becomes even more daunting because they keep adding more films to it. But we've finally decided, now Richard is officially co-host... It seems like apt because he's a big Bond fan, and it's something that I should be more knowledgeable about because I'm British and so is Bond. So the way we're going to tackle this is in six bite-sized chunks, four films apiece. So there'll be we're going to do them every couple of months. So the last one, the Daniel Craig-centric show, will be out just before Bond 25, which is currently scheduled for a February 14th, 2020 release. Hopefully it will stay there, or this whole thing will be really poorly timed. But hey, that's where it is now. And the other reason we split it up into bite-sized chunks is because there's quite a lot of Bond fans on the Lambcast family, and we want to give them all an equal shot at being on the shows to discuss what hopefully are their favourite batch of the shows, or the films. So, Bond fans, you say? You're here? You listen? Let's meet some of these Bond fans, shall we? First up, joining me today, we have my co-host from Kirkham Movie Day. He's the man with the Midas touch. It's Richard Kirkham.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Richard. Actually, yeah, it's 3 a.m. Yeah. Also joining us from Hollywood Consumer, she knows never to order red wine with fish. It's Amanda Kirkham.
Hi.
Hi, Amanda. Also joining us from Exploding Helicopter, for once he's exactly where I want him. It's Will Slater.
Choose your next witticism carefully, Jay. It may be your last.
And finally, from Blogging by Cinema Light, he doesn't know much about guns, but he knows a little about women. It's James Wilson.
What, do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond. I expect you to talk. I love that scene. Okay, so we will be talking about the James Bond franchise. But before we do that, we have another franchise to discuss first. We have some business to attend to. Every week on this show, we ask one of our guests to rank possibly the best franchise of all time. Who knows? And that honour this week falls to Will, because James and Amanda have already done it. So, Will, I know you've seen at least four films in this franchise, because I've lent you three, and the fourth one has an exploding helicopter in it. So please, can you rank the Jurassic Park franchise?
Oh, Jay, you should have prepared me for
no,
this.
No, it's a surprise.
I can scarcely remember the films.
They've got dinosaurs in them.
They had the dinosaurs in, yes. Okay, it's beginning to... distant memories are beginning to come back to me. I think this is fairly straightforward. I would probably say... I'm going off a very sketchy memory here. So I am going to say... the first Jurassic Park is the best one. I really enjoyed Jurassic Park 3. And so I'm probably going to say that is my number two pick. Then I'm going to say a Jurassic Park 2 as third, and then Jurassic World. Is that the fourth one?
Yes.
Jurassic World as the last one. I don't think it's a bad movie by any stretch of the imagination, but it did seem to be just repeating a lot of the same beats that we'd got in previous films. So it was all right. I enjoyed it. But yeah, I think that's going to be bottom of the pile.
And you haven't seen Fallen Kingdom?
No.
That's fine.
I'll see it eventually. Yeah. It just doesn't. You know, when it's on TV, I'll watch
it. It'll hit streaming at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no reason to actually seek it out wait till it comes.
So where does that put me as putting?
I was just going to say we're going to get retort here. Right?
Yeah, putting three at number two means you are incorrect with your order. not many people have done that. That is actually the highest it's been placed. You are joint with Audrey puts it at number two as well because she loves Alessandro Nivolo, who is Billy in Jurassic Park 3, who is terrible. I hate him. So yeah, you're joint with her, but you know, you're my wife would put it in a similar ranking, so it's not. She'd put it first actually, which is insane. But she'll never hear this, so it's fine. So yeah, you're not alone in liking it. I can understand. Like a lot of people don't like The Lost World that much. I can see some. It has its flaws, but Jurassic Park 3 has far more, in my opinion. No. But hey, it's got more Sam Neill. It's got. It's not a terrible all round. It's got Woody H. Mason.
Well, I remember things from Jurassic Park 3, and Jurassic Park 2 may well be a better film if I went back and rewatched it, but I just don't remember a single thing from that film. So. That's the basis of my ranking.
That's
so
what
it's,
I find odd because I find Jurassic Park 3 to be really unmemorable, apart from a couple of scenes. Maybe it's because I've watched the other ones far more. Like, other than the birdcage scene, it's and the talking raptor on the plane, it's a very forgettable film for me. But hey, that's fine. Okay, well as always, we will move on and discuss no more. So thank you, Will, for ranking those films. And now let's get into our James Bond discussion. Before we get into the individual films, we're just going to kind of go around the horn and see where we are with our own respective Bond fandoms. So I'll kick it off by saying I've seen all of the films. I haven't seen most of them for about 10 years because the last time I watched them, I did a run through of watching all of them in a row over the course of a couple of weeks during my last few months of university when I had lots of work to do on my computer. So I just stuck them on in the background and watched them. So they're just in this big blur of like... Connery being sexist, and then Roger Moore being ridiculous, and then Dalton being serious, and then Brosnan being infuriating. I have my problems with all of the Bonds, if I'm honest. We'll get to that more as the year goes on. So I three of the four films we're talking about today, I basically watched for the first time this weekend. I had no memory of anything other than some classic scenes from Dr. No. Like, from Russia with Love and Thunderball, could have been made yesterday in terms of how much I've remembered about them. But, of course, Goldfinger is Goldfinger, and will always be. So, Amanda.
Yes.
Where did your Bond appreciation come from?
Having the father that I have, I grew up watching Bond, and so I actually, as I was told, License to Kill was the first official movie that I saw in theaters because my dad took me when I was a baby. Apparently, I slept through the whole thing, so I was a pretty good baby. But yeah, so that's kind of where my... introduction to Bond started, and I, of course, Sean Connery is my favorite, so I've seen those films probably the most of all of the Bonds. And then, actually, when I was in college, I took a James Bond cinema class where we watched all the films, and of course, I went to USC, and so they had actual theaters that you took the class in, so you watched it. I got to see most of them on the big screen on actual film. And that year that I took that class, they also had a Bond festival. And so they had, I think it was right before or right after Quantum of Solace came out. So they had some of the people that were involved in that. And so that just kind of reinvigorated my love of Bond. And so, yeah, that's kind of my history with the franchise.
Okay. It seems natural to then go into Richard. Richard, why did you do this to your daughter?
Well, it's a genetic disease, I think. When I was a kid, my parents had some of the Bond novels, and I found them, looked at the covers, and said, I don't know what's going on here, but that's something I'm interested in. And when the movies were coming out, I had not seen... the first two in theaters. The third one, I think, was out or just coming out. my older brother was a big fan of the films. We were in New York City when Ian Fleming died, and we saw the headlines in the paper, and I remember how upset he was about that. And the next year, he took me to one of those double feature releases that they would do where they would re-release the films, and I think we saw Dr. No and Goldfinger. Those were the two that I think I started with. And then after that, I saw all of them, eventually catching up. The first new one that I saw in theaters was on Her Majesty's Secret Service. And I've seen every Bond film multiple times. Everybody, of course, has their favorites, and we'll be talking about all those sorts of things. James Bond is my favorite fictional character. I've devoted probably as much space on my own blog page to Bond films as I have to Jaws, so that'll tell you how significant it is in my life. And I anticipate every Bond film immensely, and when they live up to my expectations, I'm incredibly happy. If they disappoint me, I'm still happy that I have a Bond film, and I have to reconsider and think about it a little bit more and then decide whether or not I was right to be disappointed. And I've reconsidered a couple of films. I've improved my view of them over the years, but definitely, like I said, I'm steeped in Bond mythology. I've read all the books. I read the current books when I get them, and I don't see everything. I'm not on MI6 every day, but there's so there are people who maybe are a little bit more involved than me, but it's definitely my bailiwick.
Very nice. Okay, Will, what about you?
Well, I am a huge James Bond fan. I've seen all of the films in the series many, many times. These are films that I grew up with. So I was a kid in the 80s, and my parents had taped a whole bunch of movies off of TV, and there were quite a few of those were James Bond movies, and they deemed them what videos that were suitable for me to watch as a young child. So there's a list of about 20 films which I have seen just I can't begin to tell you how many times. So yeah, during summer holidays, I would be able to just go over to the video cupboard and pull out movies to sort of watch during the summer holidays, and yeah, many of those would have been Bond movies. So I've seen some of the films that we're talking about today more times than I can possibly even count. And until I was a bit older and could start making maybe some more independent choices about sort of films that I watched, yeah, for a long time the Bond movies were just the height of film excitement. So yeah, they're films that a series that I am really keen on. But it's not just really nostalgic appeal that these films have for me. I mean, I think as a much older adult now, looking back at these series, I can appreciate the fact that the James Bond films are one of the most, if not the longest running film series, film franchise that exists. It is one of the most successful film series, and in many ways it's one of the most influential franchises that are around in terms of the style and spectacle, in terms of setting standards for what audiences want and can expect from a movie. Then I think the James Bond movies changed, shifted the needle on the dial in terms of that. I think they laid the foundations for the modern action movie. And even if you don't like the films, they are fascinating cultural artifacts, because over the decades they've had to deal with recasting, changing actors, they've had to deal with changing tastes, changing social attitudes, and you can trace all that through the history of the Bond movies. So I think they are, whether you like the films or not, they are a hugely important it is a hugely important film series to look at.
Agreed. Yeah, that's why I've been kind of looking forward to doing these. There's a lot to talk about with them, and we're going to try and keep the show as short as possible. But I feel like if we were doing all 24 films in one go now, the show would never end. No. So, James, what about you? Where do you stand with the Bond franchise?
Well, I grew up in the 60s, and so they were a an ever-present part of the culture. When I was a kid, I read all the novels, and I was forbidden as a child to go see them in the theaters. The first movie I saw was Honor Majesty's Secret Service, which I remember distinctly thinking, wow, that must have cost $1 million. And I was really lucky because at that point, they say that the first James Bond you see is the one you consider to be the best. And I got George Lazenby. So I'm really
I had Pierce Brosnan. So that is not always the case.
So I feel like I can be very objective about every new Bond that comes along. I've written too much about the James Bond series on my blog. There's just so much on there. You know, there's a Now I've Seen Everything department. There's been a Don't Make a Scene feature on all four of the movies we're talking about today. I could go on and on and on, but I won't. I don't particularly have a favorite James Bond. But the one thing that happens with me is that since For Your Eyes Only, a select group of friends go see the first showing of every new Bond that comes out, and it's become a ritual. And, you know, as has been previously said, the thing has been extraordinarily influential on not just action movies, but movies in general, in style and how they go about things. It's been interesting to see how Bond has been affected by other franchises that have come along and have made changes in their way of doing things. And, but it's always interesting. Bond is always on top. It's managed to survive after so many critics have, dismissed it and said, well, isn't it time for this thing to go away?
There's been quite a few films in the franchise where it would have been okay to say that, I think.
Yeah. But it never does. And there have been points where it was going to stop. And
the points where it did.
Yes. The one particular point where it did. And they were even thinking of selling the franchise. But it came back and made more money than ever. And it's just a perpetual success story. And I think that's due to the production team, which has been consistent all the way through. The only thing that's changed is that people have died, and it's a standard of quality I think all franchises aspire to, as far as consistency and, you know, making a lot of money.
Okay. Well, that should give you some idea of where we're all standing with Bond. So let's get cracking with Dr. No. It's released in 1962, directed by Terence Young. I was shocked that all these films were released 1 year after each other.
Well, like, yes.
It's just like, amazing.
Pretty quickly in the first few, yeah.
Yeah, so...
they were very quick.
So, Dr. No. When MI6 agent Strangways and his secretary are killed in Jamaica, James Bond is dispatched to find out what happened, uncovering the plot of Dr. No, an operative for Spectre, the Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge, and Extortion, who intends to disrupt the US space launch with a radio beam. I hate Spectre. It's a ridiculous acronym. It's so labored.
Yeah, there have been worse.
Just the fact that Special right. gets two letters and Counterintelligence gets one. Just annoys me to start with. Anyway. So James, we'll start with you with Dr. No.
Dr. No was a really interesting experiment, because they were basically trying to make, you know, they had the Ian Fleming novels. Broccoli and Saltzman bought them. Saltzman bought them. Broccoli wanted to make them. and the two teamed up and then had no idea how to make the movie and basically gave a bunch of technicians the freedom to do anything they wanted. Ken Adam, they just let him go crazy with the sets. They had $1 million to work with, the lowest budgeted of all the Bond films. And it's really interesting in what they chose to emphasize. Number one, they got a really good actor that nobody knew, Sean Connery. They were trying to get Cary Grant, but he wouldn't. Number one, he would have been the entire budget, and number two, he wouldn't sign up for multiple contracts, which is something Broccoli and Saltzman for multiple movies, which is something the producers emphasized. And it is a good cracking little science fiction movie. It's not the best spy movie in the world, but
it's a detective film.
It really is. Yeah. It really is. I went to see on the 50th anniversary, I went to see it again in a theater, and I was surprised by things that I didn't notice from seeing them on video. And number one, you know, whenever Bond gets into a fist fight, his knuckles get bloodied. Little details like that. The big things about the film that differentiates it from the novel is that they put in much more humor. And this was at the insistence of Sean Connery, who thought that they were a little too – the scripts that they had made – I guess there were five screenwriters on this at various times. And he had – the opinion that it needed more humor and it needed to be funnier.
But not even, so much that that Dr. No turned out to be a monkey.
Yes, which was evidently in the draft by Wolf Mankiewicz and Richard Maybaum.
I want to see that film. I wouldn't like it, but I want to see it.
What's funny is that the first draft was written by Saltzman's secretary, Joanna. Well, she didn't consider herself a secretary at the time, but Joanna Harwood wrote the first draft and ended up doing the final draft of it after it was going through various screenwriters. But they were also making things up on the set. Young was a big influence. He very much changed the script as he was going along, and Connery was adding things as they were going along as well. It's a really good cast. Probably the most well-known of the people in it was Joseph Wiseman as Dr. No, who has a great performance. He was always an idiosyncratic actor, and he's wonderful in this. They said about Connery that he was a diamond in the rough, and Dr. No really is a diamond in the rough because it's really sexist, it's racist, and you know, these are things that they took care of later on in the franchise and basically kind of, you know, filed things down so that they were less offensive, although as we'll discuss, the Connery films are, you know, very rapey. And it's just a good overall good introduction. I was reading a couple of interviews with people lately where they said they really didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know if it was going to be a success. The very early films, they were expecting to be out in 10 years, if that. And this one, they gave it all they could. Dr. No wasn't supposed to be the original one. Thunderball was, but because of rights issues, they didn't make it. So Dr. No, they went with. It's just a good overall film. And Connery's really interesting to watch because his performance changes when he's in Jamaica to when he's in Pinewood, doing the interiors, because he becomes much more refined when he's in England than he is in Jamaica. and kind of set the style for how he was going to play it for the rest of the series. I've gone on too long with trivia and not much about
the film. Did you like the film?
I liked the film. It's a good film. It's a good part of the franchise. I'll stop now.
Okay. Richard, what are your thoughts on Dr. No?
Well, Dr. No is top five for me in the Bond franchise. And Sean Connery's introduction as Bond, of course, is classic. It's iconic. It's been parodied for 50-plus years now. And it sets the standard for everything that comes later on. The most iconic introduction of a character is Honey Rider coming out of the ocean in that white bikini, and the world suddenly realizes this is something a little bit different. This is this is going to put sexuality right in your face. And in 1962, I mean, there was sexuality, but it was often masked and hidden and double entendres, and this was... Yeah, no, this is right there. Let's look at this. And we get Sean Connery singing to her at one point. There's a little bit of extra jelly on top. Who wouldn't want to enjoy that? This introduces so many of the tropes of the films, the monologuing with the villain, the explosion of the impenetrable secret fortress, the sacrificial...
Lamb.
Mm-hmm. yes. You know, that sort of thing. And, of course, the girl who gets swept up in the whole process. As a kid in the 60s, of course, the spy thing became the biggest thing in the world next to the space stuff that was going on at the time. And, you know, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. came out, and that's basically the story they did every week. It was a spy catches up with a girl somewhere who has to kind of join him temporarily, and there's a romance, and they solve some problem, and then they move on. And that's so much of what goes on in these films, and it was all set up by this particular story. It's a little bit different from the book, but not a lot different. I kind of miss the guano killing Dr. No at the end. That would have been disgusting. But other than that, I there's just so much about this film that is awesome. I do think that the apex scene of the movie, which tells you that this is not just, a tea and crumpet spy film, is when Bond shoots Professor Dent repeatedly. That is just a brutal sequence, and it sets the tone for Bond. He seems like he's a relatively polite and sedate person most of the time, and you could reason with him, and nope, he's a killer, and you've had your six.
The Aaron Newirth, friend of the show, he'll play on one of the Roger Moore episodes, I reckon. He has a pet tarantula called Professor Dent, which now I know where that name comes from. Yeah. I enjoy the animals in these films. Will, what are your thoughts on Dr. No?
Well, for me, Dr. No is embryonic Bond. So there are a lot of the elements that we know and recognize from the Bond series. So you have the exotic locations, the beautiful women, the quips, the glamour. But with Dr. No, compared to the films that would come afterwards, it's fairly low key. So whilst it has all of those elements, the later films would deliver them with a lot more brio, with a lot more exuberance. And as I think has already been mentioned, I mean, this is in terms of the action that we see on here, you know, Bond is very much more of a detective in this film, which is something that slowly disappears throughout the series. So he goes and finds stuff out. He makes deductions. He does a bit of sleuthing. Some of the action here, there are a couple of fights. There's a car chase here, but it's fairly conventional stuff. But as has already been mentioned, it's really it's really the style that this film delivers here in terms of the locations, the women, the quips. You know, this was a fairly modestly budgeted movie, and the lowest of the entire series. And they spent most of that budget on the location, on like, okay, we're gonna set this film in Jamaica, on getting the crew out there. So you can see, you know, this film does benefit from, you know, the kind of if you've watched a lot of cinema from the 50s and 60s, this, you know, the kind of the going on location film, what, you know, they obviously, you know, those tended to be the sort of the bigger budget movies. So they obviously, this is their decision here to sort of, right, we need to kind of get this out on location. And we've only got limited money. We're going to spend our dollars there. That was a kind of their way, I guess, of trying to be able to deliver the glamour that they wanted to and compete with the film. Films that had bigger budget, and yeah, as Richard has said, the Bond's introduction in this film is fabulous. I mean, Connery just looks magnificent with his dark hair, the cigarette dangling out the corner of his mouth, and he just oozes a kind of suave diffidence. And yeah, we have to give a lot of credit for what Bond looks like in this movie, or how he acts, down to the director Terence Young. You know, if you read about the Bond series and you listen to people involved in the making of these films, it seems that Terence Young was very instrumental in setting the tone and establishing the style of this film. And it seems that he took Sean Connery under his wing. Connery, you know, let's not forget, someone who, you know, grew up in Scotland, left school at 13, worked as a milkman. You know, Terence Young kind of schooled him in sort of like how to dress, you know, what to, you know, schooled him in you know, fine drinking, in how to carry himself in sort of social situations. And yeah, it is remarkable. And I think that I'll just sort of finish by saying it's remarkable, given that this is a first film, and the fact that they had no idea how many of these films that they were going to be making, how many of the elements that we know and recognize as a Bond film are in this movie. So you have the, you know, distinctive title sequence. You have the gun barrel intro. You know, John Barry is on board in the first film, as is Ken Adam, the set designer, you know, as is Ted Moore, the director of photography, Peter Hunt, the editor. You know, so many of these elements that would be so crucial to the development of the series are there in the first film. And, you know, I think, you know, part of that you have to say is down to the skill of Broccoli and Saltzman to find good people and to bring them together. But you have to think that is also what a massive, you know, some of that is just a massive stroke of luck to sort of be in this film. And, you know, it just is, I think it's one of those cases of, you know, just sort of lightning striking in the bottle.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. And Amanda, your thoughts on Dr. No?
Yeah, I mean, I'd pretty much echo everything that's already been said. The fact that this is the first one and we're kind of seeing things that they're playing around with, seeing what might be coming back in the future films. And I, of course, already mentioned that Sean Connery is my favorite, but I didn't start reading the novels until I took that class in college, and the first one that we read was Casino Royale, and then we watched Dr. No, and I, of course, had seen Dr. No many times before that, but having read one of the novels right before seeing this and seeing Sean Connery in the role, I'm more and more convinced that he is the perfect representation of the Bond from the novels. And so I think, again, that was good casting, good directing. If I recall, Ian Fleming kind of had an issue with him being cast,
but then
ended up loving his performance so much that didn't he write, I think he wrote part of, Bond's background into, the novels to match Sean Connery's.
He made him slightly Scottish.
Yeah.
Also, given some of the things that Ian Fleming wasn't that keen on in life, I think it's okay for him not to have liked some good things.
Yeah. But I think it's, just proof of how good Connery is in the role, that he was not only good on screen, but he convinced the author of the original character to slightly change that character's story. And then the only other thing that I guess I'll mention is that I thought it was interesting that the title character doesn't show up for, like, the first hour and a half of the movie.
Like 20 minutes before the end.
Yeah. And so I thought that was interesting. I mean, you hear about him and he's a presence, but you don't get him until the very end of the movie. And I just thought that was kind of interesting. And and I think it goes back to that whoever was saying it about it being a little bit more of a detective story than necessarily a spy story. And so it's almost like the killer is revealed at the end kind of thing. But I really like the movie, and it's definitely one of my favorites.
Okay, and we're off. I don't like this film. I appreciate what you've all said, especially Will saying we need to thank Dr. No, or give credit to Dr. No for establishing lots of things for the franchise. I agree with that. I think elements of the world building, like this is the first time that we see Bond and Moneypenny interact, but immediately like M tells them to like knock it off, forget the usual repartee. Bond's like on a mission, he's got a hurry, so like immediately we're told like, oh, so they normally banter about a little bit, waste some time. So I like the world building there, and the production design is nice. The scene where Dent goes and picks up the spider, that looks great. The weird lighting, it's awesome. I really like Connery. Connery is the best Bond, in my opinion, in my memory. Maybe that will change in the next year, who knows. But I think he's fantastic. He's got the right figure, the right attitude, the right kind of just demeanor. But
he set up everybody for what they were going to do later on. That can't be stressed enough.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody is copying Connery and putting their own spin on it, but he's
some spin more than others, but yeah.
Yeah.
Well, especially I think Connery is the prototype, especially for Craig. I think there's a direct line from what Connery's doing to what Daniel Craig is doing. He's put the least spin on it, in my opinion. But as a film, I find Dr. No to be very, very slow, with some sequences seem to be playing out in real time. For example, the directions when the evil woman whose name I can't remember, Miss Tarot. Yes, she gives Bond directions to where she is staying, no, expecting him to be killed along the way, and we see her give all of those directions. We then see Bond take all of those directions step by step. He like arrives at a quarry, he turns right, he gets the road, turns left. Just the whole thing is very arduous, and then he gets...
Hang on, no, I just completely disagree.
One's over the top of the other one.
That was done. That's a voiceover as he's doing it.
But we still see that you see far more of that scene than you need to. Like it shows you far. Like, if it was being made today, which doesn't necessarily mean correctly,
that's
if it was made
bollocks,
today,
Jay. Because within as soon as the voiceover finishes, you're then into a car chase sequence, which ends with him, you know, with Connery engineering a car going off the side of a cliff. You can't, you know, you try get rid of that, and that sequence just becomes an absolute like car crash, literally.
And the other thing is that it does some. It sets up the fact that Taro is setting him up,
yeah,
to be killed. So, you know, we're living in a day now where things are telegraphed. They just happen because they happen. They're not planned out. In 1962, you had to actually set things up before you, did the sequence. This was a different time, and it was a different era of filmmaking. A lot of what has changed about the cinema and how things have been moved into this kind of much more quicker way of telling a story is due to this entire series, because they got rid of sequences like that because you didn't need them anymore. People knew what was going to happen. You got to kind of put yourself in the mindset of where you were in 1962, of where movies were in 1962. Because they did things a little bit more
Because in another film,
you can rely on context when you have context. If you didn't have the context, if you didn't have all these things happening at one point, 10 years later, the films couldn't just rely on our understanding of what's going on and coming up. You needed to set that up, and that's exactly what this film is doing in those sequences, just like that. So today, we can have a sequence that's much quicker and efficient because we know what's coming, we know how it builds, we know how things pay off, but the only reason we know those things is because we've had the historical context to give us that insight.
But do we exactly. need to see the entire radioactive de-showering process?
Yes, because Ursula Andress is naked.
Thank you.
I disagree. I think that there's just I'll go with the driving one. I felt like there were too many directions, but it could have been cut a little bit perhaps. But the showering just went on for ages.
And here's the other thing, Jay. Peter Hunt, the editor, was also exploring, was mindful that maybe things were taking too long, and he did a couple of things. He was doing a bunch of editing in order to shortchange scenes, like the example you gave of the voiceover over him driving. But also, he'd punch up the action if it wasn't big enough.
There were a lot of sped up sequences. As well,
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about things where he would actually take out a clip of film when Strangways is killed at the very beginning. The shot is basically there's a couple of frames taken out, and that was one of the brilliant things that Hunt did. Why he's so influential in the series is because he just changed. It looks unnatural, but it gives you a little bit of oomph in the action. And he would do that throughout the Bond series when he was active through Honor Majesty's Secret Service. He'd just give it more slam just by taking out little frames and moving things along and jumping them along.
I find that to be... If you're talking about what I'm thinking about, at the start of Goldfinger, jumping ahead, when Bond first appears with like that the duck on his head, that he tosses aside. Yes. I think the same thing happens there, and I find that really jarring and just awkward to watch.
Well, Honor Her Majesty's Secret Service is the most extreme example of that, because literally that they are cutting frames willy-nilly. I like it. I think it really gives a sense of unnaturalness to it, and for me, it's one of the best things about the Bond series is that, you know, they were taking chances on doing things in a more revolutionary manner. Yes, it's jarring, but that's the point. It's supposed to be jarring. When people are getting hit and all of a sudden there's a frame missing and they've moved a couple of inches farther. It doesn't get as... I know you're talking also about sped up sections. That will get really annoying in Thunderball, but...
A lot of things get annoying in Thunderball.
Yes, they do, frankly.
But James is right. Whether you like it or not, Jay, this was something that Peter Hunt was breaking new ground with in terms of editing, and it's something that other editors then came on to adopt as a style. So, you know, these films were, you know, definitely in terms of the legacy of these films, the way in which they were edited, it has been hugely influential. And, you know, we're going to get to From Russia with Love. There's stuff in there which is just, you know, light years ahead of what was going on with other movies from this particular era.
I mean, say Hitchcock, North by Northwest, the plane in the field sequence.
Yes.
They're not doing anything like that. It's shot per shot per shot that they run uninterrupted. But the only time they would edit something is if something went wrong or if something didn't play out. But this is where they're really using editing to just give more emphasis and more power to the scene. And I just think that's an amazing innovation that they were doing. And it would come up in movies during the 60s. It doesn't do that so much now. It's gone out of favor, but it's just one more example of where the Bond series was kind of revolutionary to movies, not just to action movies or adventure movies, but to movies in general.
Okay, well, I can...
This is one of those side roads that's going to lead us to a four-hour show.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I can appreciate the innovation in the editing techniques.
We are
and where they've led.
Quite a ways into this. I'm not trying to shut anybody up. No. I'm just trying to remind everybody that we are shooting for something less than 4 hours today.
We haven't even got to the ridiculous first Bond girl name of Sylvia Trench. And just... Okay, so, well, we are almost half an hour into Dr. No, so let's give any final thoughts and a score out of 5 for that one. So, Amanda, we'll start with you. Any final thoughts on Dr. No?
No, I mean, I think I pretty much said what I thought of the film, and I think everybody else has spoken enough about the things that I didn't get to touch on, so I'll just give my score. I do think that some of it looks a little bit dated now, just because it is from the 60s, but I still think it's a pretty solid Bond film, pretty solid detective story, so I'd give it 4 out of 5.
You think Felix Leiter's sunglasses are dated?
Yes. Actually, I did notice that. I was like, he's wearing cat eye sunglasses.
He made a choice.
Yeah. Which he does in one of the other films. I forget which one, but it was one of the other three
that
I watched. Yeah.
I was disappointed that we had a different Felix in every film.
Yeah.
Everyone else is consistent.
They were trying to get the cheapest actors they could. Okay. And he was a side character.
Well, yeah, so. But they had the same, like Bernard Lee is in all of them, and Lois Maxwell, they have the same amount of screen time, if not less. Than...
Right, but you rarely see Felix Leiter except for maybe one or two scenes, so they did that to keep the budget down.
Fair enough.
And nobody cared about Felix Leiter. Really?
I like Felix.
I
like Felix too. I mean, he's great in the books, but you know, they never made him a Texan either, which is what he was in the books. They didn't even give him a claw.
If they gave him a claw, he'd be a villain in the Bond films. Is the problem? Okay, James, what's your final thoughts and final score?
4, and I do have to mention that the music is lousy.
Oh, the truth is, the music, all they do is they run the theme continuously.
Because, yeah,
and they seem to drop it in it just at random times. Yes.
Oh, he's walking across the hotel lobby.
And they did that because that was the only good piece of music that they had. Monty Norman concentrated on the Jamaican stuff. And when they got to the action films, they thought, this isn't good. The quote was, this is mining disaster music. And so they said, we need something more. And that's when they hired John Barry to take a theme of Norman's and adapt it. I don't want to get this podcast sued.
I'm sure they won't listen.
Okay, I'm sure.
If how many podcasts there are out there? Nobody else is listening.
But, you know, Barry's arrangement is the best part of the movie, music. And so that's why they used it over and over. It's basically what they had.
Okay. Will, final thoughts, final score?
Final thoughts is I would just say it's very I don't think Dr. No, I think if you're really into James Bond, Dr. No is really interesting. I think for a casual film fan, it's just probably you're going to be a little bit underwhelmed by it. One thing I would point to is that I would like to highlight is a sort of a particular sequence in this film, part of which has already been mentioned here, which is the sequence at Miss Tarrow's house where Professor Dent ends up being killed in cold blood. If we judge that scene by the standards of today, I don't think it necessarily has as much impact, but you know, if you imagine that by the standards of films that were being produced in 1962, that's a really, like, standout, like, scene to have your hero just very blatantly, cold-bloodedly gun down a defenseless man and, you know, make a cynical quip about it. And even more than that, actually, you know, prior to that particular sequence, you know, Bond is at Miss Taro's house. He knows that she's a shifty character and she's trying to sort of eliminate him, and Bond calls the police. She doesn't know that, and Bond realizes, I've got time to sneak in another shag with Miss Taro here before the police arrive.
And she's been told to keep him there for a few hours, so she's thinking the same thing.
Yeah, she's thinking the same thing. I mean, and, you know, there's also a little bit in that sequence where Bond is holding a towel, he's gripping it in a manner which suggests that he might just be about to throttle her. There's some really, as I say, by the conventions of 2019, you know, that seems, it all seems fairly pedestrian stuff, but, you know, as somebody who watches, you know, movies from all sorts of decades, you just don't see, you know, it's that standout stuff in a film from 1962. So, yeah, I think Dr. No is, it's interesting for Bond fans. It does, yeah, I don't rank it particularly high. I kind of would give this a 3.5 out of 5, I think.
Okay. Richard?
Well, in anticipation of your ranking, I'm going to automatically go higher just to rank the average.
I can go lower from where I was going to go.
No, I've already said that this is a top five for me. And when I'm talking about a top five Bond film, that's going to be a very high ranking. You have to recognize what the times were and how innovative it was for those times. I think Will got it, nailed right on the head. This is a dramatic change from the tone of most films at that time. And that sequence that I mentioned earlier with Professor Dent is a good illustration of that. The sexuality of Honey Rider, you know, like you said, all the double entendres, but the names are starting here. This is, because it is the template for a lot of films, not just Bond films, but a lot of films that come subsequently, I find it particularly influential. The only thing that I have a reservation about is how high Bond's waist is on those damn suits. So this is a 5 for me.
Jesus. Okay. I was not prepared for that. I'm gonna give it a 3, which is where I was gonna go before Richard died. Like I say, there is a lot to appreciate in this. It's just looking at it from a modern sensibility, I can appreciate where the innovations came from and what they've led to, but I prefer where they've led rather than where they started, which is the case with most things. You improve things with age, and so I'm just gonna say glad they started somewhere. Someone has made the innovation, but I just it's not a film I'm gonna rush back to. I think. It's like I say, it's quite slow, and yeah, you know, Joseph Weissman is good as the I like villains in films. We don't get enough of Dr. No, for my liking.
Not for the performance he gave, which is great.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
For what little we see of him, he's good. I'll grant him that. I just would have liked a bit more villain. Like we get much more villain in the next. Every Bond film, I think.
Yes.
And I like that more than I do with him. So yeah, I give it a 3, and let's move on to From Russia with Love, released 1 year later, 1963. Also directed by Terence Young. After Bond killed Dr. No at the end of Dr. No, Spectre are out for revenge and want to kill him, as well as obtain a code-breaking lector from the Russians. In order to do this, the Russians and British are pitted against one another, with Spectre assassin Red Grant tasked with keeping Bond alive until necessary. Also, there are gypsies. So, Amanda, it seems fitting we should start with you for this one. Because when I was looking for guests to join with the first 4 Bond films, I'm like, oh, Robert Shaw's in one of these. Let's get Amanda on the show.
Yes. Well, this is actually my favorite James Bond film. And for exactly that reason, Robert Shaw is my favorite actor. And I think he is excellent in this. I also think it's a really good spy film. I think whereas Dr. No, like we kind of discussed, felt a little bit more investigative, detective kind of stuff. I feel like there's a lot of stuff here against the Russians and with Spectre involved, and you get more spy elements. But what really sets it apart for me is Robert Shaw, who I think is an incredible presence on screen. He doesn't say anything for the majority of the film. It's just literally him, like, standing in the background. Or I love the sequence when they're on the train platform and he's following Bond as Bond is walking down the platform, and he pops up every once in a while in one of the windows, and the music is really well done right there, where it kind of pops every time he shows up. And then you get the fight sequence between them on the train and actual fighting. So I just love all of that. And I love that the setup for getting Bond out there is completely ridiculous, and everybody admits that it's ridiculous, and everybody knows that it's a trap.
Go along with it anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So, yes, this is, like I said, this is my favorite of the Bond films, and that's largely due to Robert Shaw being as awesome as he is in this.
Okay. Will, there's an exploding helicopter in this one.
Yes. It certainly is one of the earliest in film history. It's the second earliest exploding helicopter in a film, if you are interested in such trivia. Really? But we're here to talk about Bond movies, not about exploding helicopters. And
Nick plugged that show on last week's episode. Yeah,
exactly. From Russia with Love, this is a curious film within the Bond canon. I think. I mean, it has the best plot of any of the series. It's, you know, as you said in your introduction, you have Spectre manipulating the Soviet Union and the Britain, and there's some very involving subplots here, you know, regarding Daniela Bianchi's character Tatiana Romanov in this particular movie. This is a real step up, I think, if you watch this. I mean, the plot, I think, is the best of the entire Bond canon. The budget for this movie was doubled, and you can see that from the get-go, and you can see that throughout the whole of this film. This film looks superb. You know, the location for photography in Turkey is fabulous. The sets, the clothes, and just coming back to the storyline for a minute, Danielle Bianchi's character actually has a proper storyline for a Bond girl, and that's quite rare within the particular series. It's also a bit odd because, I don't know, when you think of the Bond girls and Bond series, you know, people think, oh, Honey Rider, Pussy Galore, you know, Tatiana Romanoff doesn't tend to sort of come up certainly not amongst lay film fans as much. Maybe Bond fans have a greater appreciation, but you know, she is one of the most interesting Bond girls of the entire series here. And you know, as I say, on top of that, you know, the whole Robert Shaw is fabulous in this film. He, as has already been said, he doesn't speak, but he's such a great screen presence. And you know, when you get on board that train, you know, you have one of the all time great fight sequences in that part of the film. But also you have an absolutely fabulous scene before that where Connery and Shaw are, you know, the kind of pre-fight sparring that they're doing. And it's a real moment of genuine tension. And, you know, there's some proper, I love the Bond series, but there's some proper filmmaking going on in this particular series. And yeah, From Russia with Love, it is like no other Bond movie, I think, in the series. It's a really good film. And yeah, it's, again, if you're into the Bond series, it is a fascinating film to look at and understand in the terms of the trajectory of the series.
Yeah, agreed. Spoiler alert, I do like this one. So, you know. Richard, your thoughts on From Russia with Love?
From Russia with Love is, as has already been said, a step up from Dr. No. It is a much more detailed film, and it is one of the few that really feels like a spy film. because of the intrigue that's going on. Everything else is mostly action films where everybody knows who James Bond is. There's not some big secret that's going on. This is one of those things where we've got the Soviets and their Bulgarian compatriots working against the British and their Turkish compatriots with the gypsies thrown in. And, you know, we've got Spectre kind of back behind the scenes. This is the first time we get Spectre number one, who we eventually discover is Blofeld behind the, invisible wall. Yeah, we don't really see him. And, but he's on the boat giving the directions to the team. You get a sense that this is an organization that really does have power and widespread influence. They got Rosa Klebb to come over from the Soviets, and that's a secret. And it's just, it's very intricate. Boy, when I saw this as a kid, I didn't really know what the hell was going on half the time. I just enjoyed seeing all the things that were happening. It was a little confusing at the beginning, of course, with that pre-title sequence with James Bond being killed, and then it turns out that it's not James Bond. And there's just so many cool things about this film. I've really enjoyed this, and you know, not to make it too personal, but let me tell you, Daniela Bianchi is the thing that impressed me on my, you know, she imprinted on me. This is, you know, definitely the start of my heterosexuality.
Just like to remind you that your daughter is on the show.
Yeah, I know. that black choker, that is the most attractive negligee I ever saw.
I'm sorry, Amanda. Okay, moving on. James, what are your thoughts on From Russia With Love?
It's one of the top five. It's they wanted to get this one out in a hurry because President Kennedy had mentioned From Russia With Love as one of his top favorite books. And so they put this one on the fast track. And they incorporated Spectre into this because in the original novel, it was Smersh all along, and the decoding device was called the Spectre. But they managed to take the organization from Dr. No and from an earlier draft of Thunderball and put it in this one so that they could make the Russians seem less like the enemy and open up markets for the in case they wanted the James Bond series in the future. What's great about this one is the casting is absolutely top notch. You've got Lada Lenya as Rosa Klebb. You've got Pedro Armendariz, who was dying of cancer at the time, as our man in Istanbul.
Yeah.
Pedro had been an actor in John Ford's films previously, and he was put in this as a favor to Ford. And again, like Amanda said, Robert Shaw is absolutely stunning in this movie. And like the slow introduction for Dr. No, he gets a slow introduction to this with almost with extraordinarily little dialogue. But when he speaks on that train, this is one of the few instances where you think Bond is had it. And you don't know how he's going to get out of it because Shaw's Red Grant is absolutely relentless and no nonsense. And it's a very scary scene. It's one of the best in the series. And of course the fight lives up to it. This is just a great, great Bond movie. And one of the best. And that's it.
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything said. This is probably a top five for me. I haven't quite worked out my Bond ranking, but this is definitely up there. For everything everyone said, it's just a really solid Bond film. We've kind of built on Dr. No, added a few things, but this is Desmond Llewellyn is in. This is his first Bond film.
This is his first Bantam.
He's not
yeah.
quite Q. He's just equipment officer from Q Branch. But apparently, he was always old. He was never not. Just he was always the same as he did in whatever his last film was. Not Dying of the Day.
This is the start of all the gadgets in
yes.
a Bond film.
And it's yes. such a cool gadget to start with. The case is awesome. I love the case. It's not very gadget. Well, so, but it's partially gadgety because you have to, if you open it wrong, it lets off the tear gas. But in most cases, it's just it's a case with secret
exploding
pockets.
Talcum powder.
Like, there's yeah. a hidden yeah. knife. There's hidden gold. I love it. It's great. I like that Will pointed out Daniela Bianchi. She's fantastic as well. Love Robert Shaw. He's great in this. This is the youngest he's ever been, I think. It's just he's so stern. It's just like a furrowed brow and everything he does when Rosa Clare punches him in the stomach. I didn't realize that I'd heard of Rosa Clare, but I knew she was in one of these films. I didn't realize that she was in the same one as Red Grant. So you got two iconic Bond villains in the same one. And I'd love all the twists and turns, all the spy stuff, all of the like double crossings. It's great.
And one of my favorite things about this is the spice training school in Smersh.
Oh, yeah.
Spectre Island.
On Spectre Island, where they've got, you know, they're chasing people with flamethrowers. It's one of the funniest gags ever. It's like, yeah, they're doing this to real people. Yeah.
How many films has that been copied by?
Gosh, they so did it many. In Get Smart. They did it in Man from U.N.C.L.E. Half of Hen. Yeah. But actually, no, they don't do that very much in the Bond film.
It's in Goldfinger, but with the Q Branch.
I'm talking about the training on the Spectre, the spy camp. In the spy series in the 60s, everybody had a variation on this. And it's such a funny joke because it's like, okay, we use live ammunition and live targets. And, you know, we have to dispose of the bodies later. But it's one of those things who's volunteering for this? And
we need you to pretend to be James Bond. Here is a mask. You don't need to wear a mask.
It will be all right. Don't worry about it. We just want you to be James Bond for a night, okay? Sounds like a good job.
Everyone wants to be James Bond for a night. This is your chance. Run.
And the guy has a full face mask, and he's got a mustache underneath. Yeah. So you know that it's not James Bond.
Yeah, they had to reshoot that. Apparently.
They had to reshoot it because nobody understood.
People thought it was actually John Connery.
Like I said, I was confused.
This is a solid movie all the way through, and my bar is it a good movie or is it a good James Bond movie? And this is a good movie. This is great.
My only problems, I mentioned the gypsies in the introduction, kind of feels just there's elements of the gypsy subplot that are superfluous a little. And that's where you get the most like of the time sexism of there's these two women fighting over the chief's son, and Bond wants them to stop, so he has to decide instead. So they are both presented to him to spend the night with, and he has to pick one in the morning. It's a little bit like it's not great in a Me Too era. many of the Bond films aren't.
This is going to be a 6-hour series. We're going to start going into
that rabbit hole.
That's just, so I just kind of made a note of watching this. Like, this probably wouldn't do this today. And the film,
wouldn't make Gone with the Wind today, would you?
I haven't seen Gone with the Wind.
You know, we can't legislate.
I'm not saying it's not
for the social attitudes of the past.
Well, it's a topic of conversation. I'm not knocking it as a problem with the film. I love the film. We could not judge.
Imagine all the protests from the LGBT community over their portrayal as Rosa Klebb in the film.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and more on that in Goldfinger. And the From Russia with Love does end a few too many times. I didn't need the boat chase. The train fight is wonderful. The train fight is one of the best sequences in the four films of Dawn of today.
But Jay, you know, like there is
From Russia with Love does have that sting in the tail ending. So you have
yes.
you have the boat chase, and then it seems like everything's okay, and then you have that sequence at the end of the film where Rosa Klebb turns up and tries to steal the Lecter. But you know, you look at films that are being made today. Look at something like The Dark Knight, the Dark Knight, which everyone fucking wets their fucking pants over. Like, that film ends about 10 million times. You know, there's like added on ending. At least the Bond movies knew when to stop, which is like, yeah, we'll have a little sting in the tail and then we'll end. Like, you know, films today, they're now like locked into some sort of like, you know, nuclear arms race of like having, yeah, you thought this film had ended. Here's another one. You know, I don't think you can knock From Russia with Love for its ending when you look at the films that we have today where, you know, they don't seem to know when to end because they're trying to shake the viewer out of their expectations of what films are going to deliver.
Well, just because they have the same problem today doesn't mean I can't say it was a problem back then. I'm not saying it's a bad film. It's got like four endings to it, and it had one too many.
Must really like sort of like Hong Kong movies from the 1970s, where the hero defeats the villain, and then the end just slaps up on the screen. There isn't even a second in between the bad guy dying and the end credits just coming up on screen. That must be your ideal movie.
From Russia with Love has four endings. I'd have been fine with three. Right, you have they escape from the train, great. Then you have the kind of the car chase with the helicopter, get away from that, fine. Then you have the boat chase, and then you have Rosa Klebb sting at the tail. You take out the boat chase, I think it's perfect, because the boat chase, it feels really, it's not a good boat chase as well. The way that it ends, all of the boats like line up in a nice row, perfectly lined up with these barrels that have been spilled. Bond shoots a flare at one, they all blow up. It's not a great sequence.
You're making the mistake of judging this film by the standards of 2019.
I don't think it's a mistake, but okay.
You know, name me another film made in 1963.
I couldn't even do where, that.
Hey, the boat chase and the explosions are one thing that helps give the movie a little bit of scale. Everything else in this movie is very mm-hmm. intimate and small, and you're supposedly stepping up from Dr. No. You need something that is bigger. The helicopter, exploding helicopter, is solid, really solid, but the boat chase and the multiple explosions are the thing that – otherwise we don't have a Hidden Fortress exploding at the end, that's kind of what we needed to have there.
The villains have to get the decoding machine back or kill Bond. That was the mission, and Grant failed, and they have to keep pursuing him. So it becomes a chase after that. And I'm fine with the boat chase, and I'm fine with the helicopter chase, even though it's a direct steal from North by Northwest.
I'm scared to say anything now because we're just going to attack you. I'm not allowed to have problems with these films, apparently. I really liked the rivalry between Klebb and the chess guy whose name I can't remember.
Kronstein.
I liked the Darth Vader and Tarkin relationship they had. So that was nice. Okay, final thoughts and scores from Russia with Love. Will, we'll start with you.
My final thoughts is I'd just like to say we should also appreciate, you know, we need to appreciate the context of the times. And, you know, back in 1963, you know, most people probably had never left the country. I mean, most people in 1963, if they'd left the country, it was probably because they'd fought in World War II. You know, so the idea, you know, so showing these exotic locations, you know, these films were essentially a window on the world. And, you know, one thing that really stands out for me is just a little moment in this film where Bond is in his hotel room and he phones down to reception and he orders some breakfast, which is, you know, green figs, yogurt, and coffee, very black. And, you know, audiences must have been agog.
Fig?
What is a green fig?
What's yogurt?
Why would you have it with yogurt? Like, you know, I mean, this is, you know, this is the kind of the Bond persona, you know, that he can just, you know, swan into an alien country. You know, he just phones down his breakfast order and it's all this foreign food that he's ordering. And he's just doing it with just, you know, as if it's, you know, as if he's just sort of saying, oh, you know, can you bring up my laundry? You know, that. You know, I think looking back at these films, we can lose sight of some of the elements like that that add to the kind of cachet of the sort of the Bond persona. But From Russia with Love is an anomaly within the Bond series. It has one of the best plots as we've already kind of all alluded to here. I think this is a great Bond film, and it is just a great film, full stop. So I would give this a 4.5 out of 5.
Okay. Richard.
All right. Well, I've already expressed my love for this film. There are so many things about it that are great. The villains are fully formed. You get some interaction between them. Spectre is fleshed out a little bit more. That becomes a big deal later on. And one thing that we haven't mentioned yet, and I'm going to be an advocate for this, is that you do get a theme song sung by a pop star that is, I think, very good. I like Matt Monro, and I thought that the song was great. It doesn't appear, they don't do the vocal version of it over the titles, but it appears later in the film, or early in the film, and then they have it at the conclusion. And that kind of sets a precedent for what comes later. All the other subsequent theme songs that sometimes work and sometimes don't, you know, they're following a pattern here. And I think that they finally figured out, I won't say finally, they have figured out that we need to create an identity and a brand that goes with each one of these films. And one of the ways to do that is by having a theme song. And I think they have a good start on this one. You know, the James Bond theme is terrific. It's universal. It's going to appear in all of the subsequent films. But having a unique theme song for each film, I think, is just an extra good touch. And, you know, if I'm giving a ranking, this is a 5.
Okay. James?
Also, first title pre-sequence and first sting in the tail. And I give it a 5.
5. Okay. Amanda?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with what everybody's said so far. Love the music, love the theme song. Again, I'll say Robert Shaw's thank you. And so yeah, like I said, my favorite of the Bond films. It's a 5 out of 5 for me.
Okay, and I'm going to give it a 4.5 because I saved my fives. Very stingy with 5 out of 5 scores. But this is like I said, one of the best Bond films I've seen. It's fantastic. Like, we're talking about my next one. My favourite so far is probably Goldfinger, and that doesn't get a 5. So yeah, this is just great. If you haven't seen any classic Bond films, you've only seen the newer stuff, you want to go back and watch some stuff, then watch From Russia with Love. It's great. Okay, Goldfinger. Next year, 64. This is directed by Guy Hamilton, not Terence Young. And this sees Auric Goldfinger, played by Gert Frobe. He's been deemed a potential threat, so Bond is tasked with keeping him under surveillance. And it turns out he's planning to irradiate all the gold in Fort Knox, making his own private stash incredibly valuable, but not before Bond can play golf, avoid a laser, and try to screw the gayness out of a lady. So, it happens in this month. Well, we'll start you off with Goldfinger. What are your thoughts?
I think Goldfinger is what we can probably understand as one of the first recognizably Bond films. So I think Goldfinger establishes a formula which pretty much would continue uninterrupted for the next 30 years, maybe even up to today. So you have the unrelated opening action sequence, you have some scenes where Bond spars with a villain. He then enjoys their hospitality. There's a big finale and a sting and tail ending, and, you know, up the titles and, you know, Britannia rules, okay, by the end of the movie. I mean, Goldfinger is regularly listed in the sort of the top three Bond films of all time. If you look at these lists that exist online, Goldfinger is regularly up there, and there's a reason for that, and it's because it probably has the best villain, henchman, and Bond girl of the entire series. I mean, it has more iconic scenes than you know that you can possibly shake a stick at. Even if people don't care about Bond, they're going to understand. Oh yeah, girl painted in gold. You know, the bowler hat wielding henchman. Exactly, the laser table, taking off a wetsuit to find an immaculately, groomed tuxedo underneath. I mean, this is, I think, the sort of the first fully formed Bond statement. And yeah, this is, as I say, it regularly appears in the top three, top five of all Bond movies. And I am not here to tell you, to give you any kind of different view. I mean, this is top quality James Bond action. I would say I would strike a couple of notes about this film. I mean, this is a fabulously entertaining movie. This is top quality Bond. There isn't really that many great action sequences in this film. And I think it's because the rest of the film is so entertaining that you don't really notice. And, you have in this film, there are a lot of, as I say, very entertaining scenes. The golf scene where Bond and Goldfinger meet, and there's some sort of verbal sparring, and there's some golf sparring that is going on there. It's a wonderful sequence, and these types of scenes sadly get squashed out in later films in favor of putting more action in, and I think that's a little bit of a shame. But yeah, Goldfinger is one of the definitive Bond movies,
and just Bond's caddy. It's a delight.
Oh, yeah.
Did you switch him, sir?
Now we've got him. Loved him. Okay, Richard, your thoughts on Goldfinger?
Yeah, Goldfinger is my favorite, probably like a lot of people. And it is, in fact, the film that creates this whole idea of the subsequent Bond films. From Russia with Love and Dr. No are good films. They're of a scale. They are... quality pieces of work. This is the one where everything explodes. This is the one where the ground shifts underneath us. The plot of this movie involves robbing Fort Knox.
No, wait.
I know. Ultimately, that's
it's
not
sillier
what's
than
happening.
That.
But the plot of the book involves robbing Fort Knox in reality, and then they make this fantastic adjustment, including the Red Chinese in the course of this, but it's still, we're going to invade and take over Fort Knox. That's frickin' outrageous. Anything else is just like, are you kidding me? We're going to do that. And that's when the over-the-top stuff starts, and it's so much fun. And when James Bond meets Pussy Galore and she tells him her name, it's like he must be dreaming. This is exactly the kind of thing that the rest of the series is going to be doing over and over and over again. The other names that we talked about before, they are so subtle in comparison that this is ridiculous. And the fact that she's, she's immune to his charms, as they euphemistically say, is it just introduces this other concept. And to be honest with you, this is the time that a villain goes out in the most spectacular way that you can imagine a villain going. I just love that sequence with Goldfinger going through the window of the plane at the end, squeezing out that tiny little window and popping like a cork on his way out. The henchman odd job, crushing the golf ball with his hand. Bond recognizes that what he's facing is something that is potentially, well, we talked about Robert Shaw in the previous one being formidable. Oddjob's formidable, and he has no dialogue. He just looks at you, and you go, yep, this is not good. He gets one smile, and you go, uh-oh, that's not a good move. This is great. Dangerous. And, you know, the earlier sequence where they're tracking the Rolls-Royce across Switzerland is there's that scenic stuff that we were talking about before. This is another travel log that we're getting an opportunity to visit other parts of the world. We see Tilly Masterson trying to take her revenge. She's the worst shot in the world. And
almost kills Bond.
Yeah. and Bond, of course, is, even though she has no interest in him whatsoever, he's still trying his charm on her, and it's going nowhere. And you have the DB5. Holy crap, the greatest gadget ever in any movie, and it's got every little switch that you can push that does something fantastic, and he gets a sequence where he gets to use them all, including, I'm not joking, an ejector seat.
Yeah.
That is over the top. That's when you push the bar a little bit further and you just say, you know what? We're going to indulge in a fantasy here. We're going to make it as entertaining as we possibly can. We know that this is nonsense, but it is the best kind of nonsense you can get into. And, I don't want to sound like a broken record on the music thing. Anybody who says that Goldfinger's theme is not the best theme is wrong. Just like anybody who says any of the Jurassic Park films, you know, that Jurassic Park is not the best one is automatically wrong. This is the best Bond theme.
You hear that, Mariah? You're wrong. Okay. I didn't say it. Richard did. James, your thoughts on Goldfinger?
Good.
Okay, Amanda.
If this isn't the best one, it's number two. This is where they've actually refined everything and put in the element of outlandishness to it. I'll just read my little blurb on it. It says, there are still thrills, but an extra coat of polish and humor is given this one, which also improves on Fleming ditching his caper for one that's a bit more practical and scarier. Connery throws in more comic bits of business and plays it a bit more detached, probably because his Bond is a bit passive in the detective department. He's basically a hostage throughout the whole thing. Screenplay carefully sets up bits early on so that no one has to stop for explanations during the later action. Lots more gadgets. That car, that laser, Oddjob and his lethal derby, that little old lady with machine gun. Pussy Galore starts the trend towards eye-rolling names, but it's Shirley Eaton who becomes iconic by becoming Gilded. Extended battle sequence at Fort Knox is the first extended battle sequence to climax the movies. Bond ends up with girl under a parachute. And, you know, it's like they had the formula. They knew what worked with From Russia with Love. They took a fairly okay Fleming novel and they just polished it to a fine sheen and even made a better plot out of it. When the James Bond series does it right, they really, really do it right. And I can't think of anything in this movie other than the little old lady with the machine gun that I would take out of the movie. And my favorite gadget on the car is the Ben-Hur tire slashers. Which is absolutely absurd, but it's hilarious.
I might take out Bond kissing Pussy Galore until she likes it.
There,
she's very much opposed to the situation.
Yes.
Until like she gives in.
Like I said, the Connery ones are rapey.
Yes.
And
I watched this one.
This with Thunderball, too.
Let me just interject a little bit here. You know, when you have a gun pointed at you by a woman, the rapey thing is probably a little bit different. The context changes. This is not out of the blue. This is, they've had this contentious relationship. And this, how is he going to reassert his masculinity? She's emasculated him by pointing a gun at him for the first three times that they've met. This is his turnaround.
But as she says, she's completely defenseless in the barn.
I think it's a bad idea to work out whether this is okay or not and move on.
Yes.
Amanda, what are your thoughts on Goldfinger?
Well, I kind of look at the first three films as like Dr. No is kind of a little bit of the like awkward teenage high school year. What's going on? From Russia with Love is kind of like the college years. You feel a little bit more comfortable with who you are and know what you're doing in life. And then Goldfinger is like, okay, I've graduated college. I know who I am. And
everything. That's perfect.
I like it.
Falls into place. Like everybody's kind of said, we get a solidification of some of the tropes with the gadgets and with the girls and, with the villains and with the locations, and we get so many iconic moments and images. I mean, the girl painted in gold, the song, Goldfinger as a villain, Oddjob as the henchman. So this is, while it's not my favorite, and I obviously have already mentioned why my favorite is my favorite, I definitely think Goldfinger is probably the best of the Bond films. And I think, yes, there are some things that maybe are a little bit off-putting now, you know, with today's standards, as we just kind of touched upon, but we're moving on quickly from. But other than that, I think that it's a really good spy film, Bond film, action film. And I love that it's a majority of it takes place in the U.S., which is great for me. So yeah, I really like Goldfinger.
Me too. up until 2013, this was the only one that was on the 1,000 Movies You Must See Before You Die list. Skyfall has been added as well. We'll get to that one. But I think it says a lot that Goldfinger is on that list, and it absolutely should be. It's also, you mentioned it's in America. This is one I've reviewed, because I did it as part of my America Road Trip series I used to do for French Show Sunday. This was my pick for Kentucky. It's quite a lot of place in Kentucky.
There you go.
Which was good.
Another exotic location.
Yeah. it's
filled just with KFCs.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's just a great film, really, isn't it? I watched this one with my wife. She hasn't seen any of the Connery Bonds. She's only seen one Roger Moore, which was The Spy Who Loved Me for a previous movie of the month. This was entertaining to watch with her, because she didn't see all of it. I think she gave up at a certain point. But you have the cold open where Bond kind of goes back to the woman's room and sees the guy going to attack from behind, reflected in her eyes. And so he turns around and uses her as a shield. Then he ends up throwing the guy into the bath, chucking in a heater or a fan, and killing the guy with the type of just shocking. Just, I could hear her eyes rolling next to me. And she asked me how these films could be considered good. And I told her that this is the best one. And I think she's vowed never to watch any more of these films, which is a shame. Especially when we get to Bond being massaged at the... Is it Miami, whoever it is he is? At the hotel. Yes. And yes. The masseuse is kind of standing there when... Felix shows up to talk to Bond, and he's like, it's man talk, guides her away, slaps her on the ass.
Well, this is Goldfinger.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, it was Gold, yeah.
Dink.
Well, just when Connery did that, and just the slap on the ass to kind of get her away, that was when she just done with the film. done with the series, I think. So it's entertaining to watch her. I'd like that Bond doesn't like the Beatles, and that is canon.
And Paul McCartney shows up in a decade and changes his mind.
Oh, yeah. He tries.
You see, that's what they should have had in Spectre. They should have had when, you know, Daniel Craig's driving along that car and the music comes on the radio. It should have been a Beatles song. Yeah, and, you know, that's what he should have, like, complained about. So that would have been a, you know, a nice callback for Bond fans to you know, to kind of like Bond films of years ago. But anyway, I digress.
That would have been nice. Yeah, get the Aston Martin. That's great. I always forget how little Tiffany Marston is in the film. Tilly. When she shows up, Tilly. I always think, oh yeah, she's the Bond girl for the rest of this film. But then she's like dead in the next scene. She's like, it's fairly inconsequential, her appearance.
Well, I would say one criticism of this film is its handling of the dramatic moments around the death of the Masterson sisters, because yes. You know, Bond yeah. has he's killed one Masterson, you know, he's killed you know, Jill Masterson, and then later on he's responsible for killing Tilly Masterson as well. And I mean it's not indifferently handled. There is some, you know, Bond is seen to sort of give some weight to their deaths, but you know, as you know, to sort of paraphrase Oscar Wilde, you know, to kill one sister might be considered, you know, careless. You know, to consider, you know, two is just ridiculous. But you know, it's that you know, that element of the film didn't strike me, is not quite as it's not handled perhaps right. as well as it could have been, but
the amount of death that Bond is witness to or causes, he just can't let it get to him, because in Doctor No, when Quirrell dies, Quirrell's a great character, passes away, just yeah. kind of move on. And the same with Karen Bay in From Russia with Love, like we see the most sentimental Bond gets as he picks up Karen Bay's cigarette holder and very matter-of-factly tells his son, your dad's dead, now do this work for me, please. Here is his effects. He doesn't deal with loss all that well, and I think that's part of his character. He's not supposed to. He can't. He wouldn't function. He'd just be a mess if he had to, like process these things.
He has to be somewhat detached. But yeah. Remember, there is that moment when when M is giving him directions about the whole thing, that he's not supposed to take this personally, and he denies that he is taking it personally and that it's a vendetta. I still think that there is a little bit of that underlying animosity toward Goldfinger as a result of Jill's death, and that's he's perfectly happy and gleeful to go after Goldfinger.
We mentioned there's kind of nice little character bits. I like Bond in his prison cell playing with the guard. That's fun. Yes. That's a lot of fun. I think the most ridiculous scene probably is Goldfinger explaining his plan and having that just a ridiculous room in this scene with the rotating pool table, the giant map, the floor revealing this scale model of Fort Knox, and then killing them all.
But that scene also makes absolutely
no sense.
I mean, it's so just for the viewer and for Bond.
Yeah.
He's going to kill them all. Even the guy who says he's going to leave, he kills straight away. Why not just say, okay, hang on, we'll talk about that in a minute. I just got to step outside for a second and kill him there.
Exactly. I mean, that just makes no sense at all. There's no point on trying to unpick the logic of that scene. And so, you know, I think after the imperiously plotted From Russia with Love, there are some things. I think as you go through the Bond series, you know, I think From Russia with Love is the best plotted one. And then as you progress from here, plotting becomes ever more, you know,
less essential.
Yeah, less essential.
Well, yeah, it's not essential in the next film, which we'll get to very soon.
It becomes getting the effect as opposed to the, you know, story logic. I mean, why crush the car that Solo is in?
It's to break the tracker. That's the only reason.
Sure.
A tracker they didn't know was there. I mean, it's just, exactly. You know, none of it makes sense.
You have to be able to justify that line, though. I have to separate Mr. Solo from my gold. You can't have that line if you haven't crushed the car.
I love the planes flying overhead and the soldiers are just falling like dominoes as it goes past. Mm-hmm. I know it's all a big ruse. I just really like that shot of the shots of that happening. It's comical.
And my favorite line of this one is, "Where's Goldfinger? Blang is golden hot."
Oh, and that bomb! The bomb is insane. It's just the wires and the spinning discs and things inside it.
And of course, the, you know, in a kind of foretaste of the sort of the nod and the wink style that would really start to assert itself in later films, the countdown clock on the nuclear bomb ends on 007. And yeah, I mean, that is the start of some really very, you know, postmodern, self-referential type of style that would really assert itself in later Bond movies.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's give final thoughts and scores. So, Richard.
Well, like I said before, Goldfinger is my favorite film in the series. It's the start of the tongue-in-cheek, over-the-top phenomena that Bond's about to become. And Sean Connery is at his best, I think, in this particular film. He starts getting a little bit bored after this, and I think you can see that in the next film in a couple of spots. But here he still seems like he's engaged in doing what he needs to do. And I could listen to Shirley Bassey any day of the week and feel like I should go and watch this movie. So this is a 5 for me.
He's not the only one who starts to get a bit bored in Thunderball. Just saying. James, your score?
5.
5. Okay. Amanda?
I really like this film, and like I said, I feel like this is where the series kind of comes into its own, and as everybody's kind of mentioned, it kind of becomes self-aware, knows what it is, and I think it does everything really well in this film. It's a 5 for me.
Well,
I really love what Amanda said about Goldfinger being James Bond, the postgraduate years. that is absolutely spot on. I mean, there's a reason this film regularly ranks as one of the greatest Bond films of all time. I'm not here to tell you any different. I mean, this is 4.5 out of 5 for me.
I'm actually going to go against what I said earlier and give it a 5. It's a hugely entertaining film. It's even if you don't like Bond films, I don't think, sexism aside, it's hard to dislike anything in Goldfinger. It's pretty much perfect. So I give it a 5. Thunderball. Yeah. 1965, back to being directed by Terence Young. Spectre, Cyclops, Emil Largo steals some bombs and hides them underwater, planning to destroy Miami Beach. That's it. It's like, it shouldn't be 130 minutes long. Like, there shouldn't be so much swimming as there is in this film. It's just, that's Thunderball. So, Richard, it's a Bond film with sharks in it. It must be your favorite.
That is a good combination, you know. But they are golden grotto sharks. They're not necessarily great whites. So that would cause it to be a step down. And let's face it, this is, like you said, it's a little long. I think it could do with a trimming of about 15 to 20 minutes, and it would be
the underwater stuff.
Well, I think the underwater stuff is cool. That's where most of the trim needs to be done, though, because that's the stuff that is unique about this. If you were to look at all of the modern films and you see how they each try to up the ante over their previous film, this is the example in the Bond series where, okay, we've done this with Goldfinger. Where do we go next? Well, let's do this. They're going to have an underwater warfare. They're going to have stealing nuclear bombs from a plane that they've done. They're going to have a face transplant. And Bond is going to escape at one point using a jetpack.
When a zip wire would have done the same thing.
Oh my God! This is like classic example of, well, let's just up everything a little bit more, and they do it probably a little much. It's you know, just like Goldfinger, it's outrageous fun. It's a little too, I don't want to say too much, because I'm not sure you can have too much. I'm perfectly willing to overindulge in the wrong kind of food and have, you know, one candy bar too many, and that's kind of the way this feels. It's like, yeah, I ate that last Snickers, and I don't feel bad about it, but I didn't really need it. There was a little too much sugar there.
Okay. James.
I'll read the synopsis here. Gadgets and locales start to crowd out Connery, and for the first time, the movie seems like a letdown from Fleming. Starts with a jetpack escape and ends with an underwater battle sequence that seems to go on forever. Underwater ballet with spear guns. So does the central atom bomb hijacking that sets up the plot. Well, one is tempted to say in motion, but it stops the movie cold. Spectre and the man with the cat is back, face unseen again. Connery appears irritated at times, but it is the all-time Bond box office champ adjusted for inflation. Bond ends up with girl in boat until they're whisked away by air-sea rescue. And probably killed if it were anything like reality, but...
Well, and she's only held on because he's holding her.
Yeah, well, like,
the guy who helped them escape is still out there clinging to a lifesaver, unable to swim. So.
Well, there are sharks out there, so. Yeah. And he's a bad guy, so we don't feel...
But he... Yeah.
Okay. Never too late to learn. It's like they had learned their lesson with Goldfinger. They knew what they were doing, and then they decided, okay, let's just put in more of everything. Part of it is the fact that they have another producer, and that's Kevin McClory, who owned the rights to Thunderball, and he wanted Connery, and Broccoli and Saltzman had him, and so they decided for this one-time movie that they were going to take on a partner, and that was going to have bad consequences for the Bond series later on. So I don't know how much McClory's influence is on this. It's probably Broccoli Saltzman, because he liked gadgets. Broccoli liked the women and emphasized that. But this is just, they're just going too far. And it's already showing where, you know, if given too much money and expertise, they can go off the rails. And, you know, the Bond series would start doing this over and over. They'd go along, build until they got absolutely crushingly outlandish. And then they would go back to basics and then start to build again. It's just sloppy too, because Terrence Young left halfway through the editing and let Peter Hunt try and pull it all together. And you see continuity errors all over the place.
They left in the dog that. Peeing in the middle of the parade.
I think that might have been deliberate. Because it kind of feels like my reaction to it. But, yeah, it's a hodgepodge. And it's certainly not one of my favorite Bond films, even though it has Connery in it.
Okay, Amanda, your thoughts?
Well, I guess if I'm following my original analogy for Goldfinger, I feel like this is...
Midlife crisis?
Midlife crisis, yes. They go out and buy the sports car that's way too cool and
there
young.
There you go.
The bright red scuba jacket.
Yeah. But I do kind of have a soft spot for Thunderball because, as I mentioned before, when I was in that Bond class, I wrote my term paper on Thunderball and Never Say Never Again and that whole issue. And I also have a soft spot for Never Say Never Again, even though it's not part of the official Bond 25.
So we're not covering that one.
You are going to cover that
one?
No,
we're not planning to.
What?
That would mean we'd have to cover the first, the Woody Allen Casino Royale.
Yeah, I haven't
so
even seen
I
that.
Completely yeah. understand why yeah. you wouldn't.
Also, it breaks up nicely into chunks of four. If you got that one, it's just, it doesn't work.
But yeah, so I recognize that there's a little, look, watching it the other day, I did fall asleep at the end in the middle of that Nevada battle and because it had been going on for 20 minutes.
I did exactly the same thing, so I'm happy about that. I had to watch it in two halves.
Yeah. But like I said, I think there's still, look, it's got sharks in it. That appeals to me. I actually really like, and I can't remember the character's name, but the redheaded woman, I like her as a...
Fiona Volpe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like her as a villain. She is kind of like Pussy Galore in that she's initially like no nonsense with Bond and she holds her own, but then she absolutely uses his ego and his personality against him. And so I like that. But yeah, it's a little long. Some of the tech is a little too gadgety. But it's a Sean Connery Bond, so I still like it. And like I said, I kind of have a soft spot for it. But yeah, it's definitely not one of the better Sean Connery Bond films.
Okay. Will.
Well, I love how this is shaped up because I love Thunderball. this is one of my favorite Bond movies. I'm not here to tell you though that this film doesn't have problems. It has got some major problems, but I kind of don't care about them. I mean, I think everyone else has kind of alluded to some of the issues with this particular film. So I'm just going to jump straight in there with the case, I guess, for Thunderball. And I think that it has in Adolfo Celi as Emilio Largo, I think it has an iconic villain, you know, with his white suit, with his eye patch, with his voice and his style. You know, he is a villain that is probably quintessentially a Bond villain. And actually, if you think about some of the Bond villains that we've seen in the previous movies, you know, in From Russia with Love, we don't really see who Blofeld is. You know, Goldfinger, yeah, he's kind of interesting. Dr. No, we barely see him until the end of the movie. Like, this is where Largo is introduced very early in the film, and he's, as I say, I think he's a quintessential Bond villain. In Luciana Paluzzi's Fiona Volpe, you have for me the best Bond girl of the entire series. I mean, she is Bond's equal. She is almost like Bond's mirror image. She is just as much a sexual predator as Bond is, and she is just as much a lethal assassin. And she also has a surprising amount, not just for the Bond universe, but also for 1965. She has a surprising amount of agency within this film. And I also think that the end of this film, Thunderball, it gives us a bravura action finale. The 25 minute like underwater action finale, you know, nobody else was doing that in 1965. Nobody else. The sheer balls of the James Bond film producers to stage that as their finale. Nobody else was doing that. You know, that, you know, to stage that as an action finale now in 2019, that would be ambitious. To do it in 1965, it blows my mind. Yes, you can sort of criticize the amount of underwater photography that there is in this movie, but nobody was doing this in this particular era. So I think it is, you know, the fact that the budgets were just increasing year on year with these films. And it, for me, is, you know, it's an example. You know, and I actually would make a defense of Thunderball on the basis of,
I think it suffers a little bit from where it sits in the chronology of the Bond films. It comes after Goldfinger, which is one of the most, you know, universally loved, universally recognized best of the Bond movie series. And after it comes You Only Live Twice, which, you know, in that film, they just go hell for leather for spectacle in that movie. You've got a villain who lives inside a hollowed out volcano. You know, they're shooting down satellites in space. You know, this film, the plot is fantastic, but it's still grounded in some kind of realism. It's not beyond the realms of possibility that they could engineer this sequence where they are able to steal these nuclear weapons and then are able to blackmail the NATO powers. So for me, I think, you know, for all the flaws that exist in Thunderball, I think there is a lot to enjoy here, and I really love this movie.
I didn't. yeah, shocking. I'm with everyone else other than Will. Sorry, Will. I found this quite arduous to get through. It's very, very... I don't want to say boring because it's a Bond film. Bond films, just by their nature, aren't boring, but there's just not enough to warrant that 2 hour, 10 minute runtime, which I can already hear Will saying, but films today do the same thing. And I agree. Films today are too long. I agree, Will.
Look at the fucking Avengers movies. Yeah. They're all like 2 hours, 45. I agree.
More happens in them. There's
yeah,
less...
just superheroes hitting each other. How interesting is that? But, you know, I digress.
Well, this is just people swimming. And intercut with, like, there's so many shots of underwater animals. I was expecting a David Attenborough, like, voiceover to come in. It's ridiculous. just like, oh, there's an octopus over there. Come back to people fighting. Oh, there's a shark. Come back to people fighting. Oh, a lobster. Just there's so much, just random animals nearby. I just didn't get on with this one. You'd like Fiona Volpate, fine. I got her confused with Domino quite a lot. They didn't look that dissimilar to me.
What are you talking about? One's got scarlet red hair. And the other one's got, like, black hair.
But it's like dark brown and a kind of a lighter reddish brown.
Oh.
On my non-Blu-ray copy, it wasn't great.
Well, I can't legislate for your colour blindness.
Fine. I think my problems with... I liked Q being out in the field. That's always fun. When he's not doing stuff in Q Ranch, that's always nice. I didn't hate the cold open when we're at a funeral, that for the opening 2.5 seconds we're supposed to at least think it's Bond, because it's the initials JB, and then he appears seconds afterwards, and he goes back to the widow's house and beats her up because it's actually a guy, which he realised because she opened the car door for herself or for himself.
Of course,
that was entertaining, and I didn't hate the jetpack. It's silly, but it's on a kind of Goldfinger level silly, so. And he's got the DB9 back again, and that's partly with shooting the water jet cannons to knock everyone over when he could have just driven away in the same amount of time.
The big tank got to hold those.
Yeah.
I won't get into it.
A lot of pressure's got to come from somewhere. That's quite a distance to get. And I liked the Spectre stuff, where they have all of the villains sat around a table when they killed number 9. Just the chair explodes. That's a very Austin Powers scene.
That's where they got it.
We get some more problematic kissing when he's at the recuperating, and he kind of forces himself on the nurse. But we're not getting into that kind of thing. Too much to talk about. It's fine.
Well, that was sexual blackmail. So
yes.
I
won't tell your boss if you join me in the sauna. but yeah, this is, you know, it's all been said. I like that Bond works out where Largo's staying because he has a shark pool. That's the last thing he said. Like, this must be Largo's house. He's got a pool specifically for sharks. He must be a villain. No one else would have this. I like that. So it's not all terrible. It's just, if it was, like Richard said, take out 50 minutes. I reckon you could take out a good 30, 45 and still make something quite entertaining. And, like, sensical. But hey, we've hit the 2-hour mark, so let's call it. Let's stop talking about Thunderball and give it our final thoughts. Let's score out of 5. James, we'll start with you.
3.
Okay. Amanda?
Well, like I said, I've got a bit of a soft spot, I think, for this film, and I do think it runs a little long, and some of the stuff is a little too over the top, but I give it a 3.5.
Okay. Richard?
All right, well, I wanted to mention two other things that we didn't get a chance to talk about. One is the music. To me, this is John Barry's best score. I just love the way the music works in some of those sequences. It is terrific. And it's not really part of the film, but part of the marketing. The posters for this movie were fantastic. Yeah. This is the kind of stuff those that would sell posters. You. Yeah, they would sell you on seeing this movie. All you have to do is walk by the theater and see that and say, I don't know what's going on there, but it sure looks like fun. And that's kind of the way I feel about the movie. It's, I criticized it. I've suggested it's got problems, and I'm about to give it a 4 because I still think it's a James Bond film that I could watch anytime.
Okay. Will?
I would agree with Richard. I think this is one of John Barry's best scores. I think the fight scene at the funeral in the pre-title sequence,
yeah.
I think that is fantastic. I think every scene with Fiona Volpe is absolutely fantastic. The flirtation scene in the car is brilliant. And that scene in the hotel room after they've enjoyed each other's company, and Fiona Volpe absolutely owns Bond with a little speech that she gives him there. I mean, that is, a little bit of trivia that she is basically repeating back apparently some criticisms that were made by some reviewers of the James Bond series and the way in which women behaved in those particular films, that they only needed to have sex with Bond and suddenly they would be on the side of righteous virtue. She repeats that back at Bond, spits that back in his face. It is a fabulous scene, and sadly it's a kind of scene that we don't see again in the Bond series. And so I would also say, I think, I'm pretty sure this is the first Bond film with Connery doing the gun barrel sequence.
Yes, yes.
It was in the previous films, it was just some random stunt man. Yeah, yeah. It was a stunt man doing.
Is there a reason why he wouldn't do it? Why he wouldn't take 3 steps, turn, and shoot?
And they did Dr. No. They did, Connery was done, so they just got his stunt man, Bob Simmons, who was also the stunt coordinator, to do it. And
it's obviously not him.
Obviously not him, but it doesn't really matter. When they went to the wide scope format for Thunderball, they coerced Connery to come in to do the gun barrel, and he did it once.
Okay.
Rather wobbly.
Fine.
Thank you. And I, as I say, as a defender of Thunderball, I would just say, watch this film and then watch You Only Live Twice. And I think Thunderball is a better movie. Make up your own minds. I would give this 4 out of 5.
Certainly better than You Only Live Twice.
We're bleeding over to the next group. We got to be careful about that one.
Yeah.
We're going to keep on rolling all the way. Let's keep on rolling all the way through, Jay. We're starting. Let's go. It's
come on. I'm ready.
I'm not going to be able to do that because I don't remember the next 15.
I'm ready to talk the next 15 Bond, well, actually, and I, Never Say Never Again.
I watched Live and Let Die 2 years ago, and The Man with the Golden Gun is kind of burned in me somewhere for various reasons. And The Spy Who Loved Me I've watched fairly recently. I can't do the rest. I'm sorry. It's been too long. And all of the Brosnans are just kind of this sticky mess in my mind. So I'm trying to forget them. I like Goldeneye. I don't like the rest. That's a year's time we'll get to them. that's going to be our Christmas show, I think. It's going to be talking about Brosnan. Wonderful. I am going to give Thunderball a 2.5 because I didn't like it. I think I've expressed why. The one part I really didn't like, the fight at the end in the boat when with Bond versus Largo and Covered Sentiments, I think is terribly staged and edited. Comparing it to the From Russia with Love train fight with Grant, which I know is not fair, but I saw them basically back to back, so Russia with Love was fresh in my mind. It didn't compare. It was very much a throw more people at it, throw more danger of. They need to keep steering the boat. So Bond and Largo keep jumping back on the wheel to steer the boat out of rocks. It was comical. It would be a comedic scene in another film, I think. So I did not enjoy that.
I would like to think that they did that deliberately to make it more outlandish. I don't think they did. I think they just did it to try and pump up some sort of excitement for it, because it's kind of sloppy.
Yes, I agree. And there's a lot of that speeding up or taking out frames in there as well. So I'll give it 2.5. If you want to know our rankings, that makes Goldfinger the best, From Russia with Love second. Then I think it's Dr. No and then Thunderball. Which I'm not really surprised at. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, no surprises.
But that'll do it for our Bond discussion today. The Lamcast Bond discussion will return in 2 months' time when we look at the next 4 films, which will introduce the worst Bond and George Lazenby.
Oh, wow.
It's going to be an interesting show. So come back in 2 months to hear about that one. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back for a game in a minute. But for now, here's a message from another LAMP Podcasting Network show.
On the Simplistic Reviews podcast, we talk movies. We talk TV. We talk...
Hello, Julie, what the heck are you doing?
Trying to make our spot sound more exciting by adding explosions.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you could have got the point across with sound effects, not the real thing.
Download the show on iTunes or at simplisticreviews.blogspot.com.
I'm sure your insurance company will cover that.
No, they won't.
No, they probably won't.
And we're back. We are going to skip the rants, raves, and reviews because it's running a little long, but if we were going to do it, I would rave about the Lego Movie, the second part. It's great. We're not doing that, so I won't.
Ollie's wonderful.
We are going to play a game. Richard has come up with a game. I don't know what that game is, but I'm looking forward to finding out. So, Richard, what are we doing?
We're going to do 007 by the numbers.
I'm going to lose this game.
Some of it is going to be easy, and some of it's going to be a little complicated. It's basically trivia questions, but they are based on statistical pieces of information about the Bond films. I've created 007 questions for each of you, and we'll just run through them one person at a time. We'll score it as we go along. Jay will keep track of the score because he knows how good I am at that. Like I said, the winner is the person who has the highest score at the end. I do have a tiebreaker in case we get to that particular point. So the order is going to be Jay, and then Amanda, and then James, and then Will. All right, Jay, your first question.
Okay.
Which decade had the most four-word titles?
Oh, Christ.
Whoa.
And I'm going to give you a 30-second limit on this.
The 60s.
That is correct.
Okay. Amanda. That's just the one that had the most films, I think.
Amanda. Yes.
How many 007 pictures have five-word titles?
Jeez. I'll just say 5.
It's so close, but that's not correct. It is 4. James.
We're doing so well.
Which actor appeared in the most 5-word titles?
What the hell? give me 10 seconds. Well, gosh, Brosnan.
That is not correct. Roger Moore.
Who loved
me? I was
going
to say Desmond Llewellyn.
Well, there you go.
I meant Fish Bond. I will correct that, but you know, smart asses are always playing the game. Will, I created this question specifically for you. How many Bond films lack a helicopter in them?
Oh, Jesus. I knew this answer a little while ago. I am going to say, oh, God.
that's 25. I'm going to say 15.
All of them but two have helicopters. Yes.
The Man with the Golden Gun?
Dr. Man No? with the Golden Gun and Dr. No are the two.
I read that trivia.
Interesting.
Jay.
Hang on. From your eyes only does not have an exploding helicopter in.
Not an exploding helicopter, but it does have a helicopter.
Oh, did you say... Oh, sorry. I misunderstood the question. Never mind.
It's okay. It's all right. Jay, how many films in the series did Walter Gotell appear in?
Oh, boy.
That depends on who he is. Three.
That is not correct.
Okay. Correct.
Okay. Who is he?
He plays General Gogol, and he's also the head henchman of Spectre Island.
Okay.
Infomercial with love.
Fine. Yes. Amanda, yes. How many 007 films did Bernard Lee appear in as M?
Seven?
He appeared in 11.
And it's Bernard.
Bernard.
Okay. No, Bernard. He's English.
Yeah. Okay, excuse me. And license is spelled correctly.
Yes.
As is Spectre.
Yes.
All right.
James, yes. How many 007 films did Judi Dench appear in as M?
Well, she did the Four Brosnans. She did seven. Eight. No, eight. She was in it.
Yes. She was in Spectre.
She was
uncredited,
Spectre.
But she does have the video callback.
Yes.
Will, since we're sticking with this theme for a second, how many films in the series did Robert Brown appear in as M?
Oh, fuck. I don't know who Robert Brown is. I'm going to say one.
He's actually in four. He plays M in all the ones that aren't Judi Dench and
Bernard Lee.
Or Bernard Lee.
There is one where M doesn't appear, and they have Tanner in that one.
Yes. And that's the worst Tanner ever.
Yeah.
That's awful. Jay, how many pictures have one word titles?
One, two, three, four. Five?
No, there are seven.
Oh, Moonraker. Which should be a swear word.
Amanda.
Yes.
What is the only one word title film from the 90s?
From the 90s?
Yes.
Goldeneye?
Yes, there's a point for you.
Yay! 1 point.
Although it does appear with a hyphen in some versions, but we're not going to split. We're not going to split hairs here.
On the poster, it's one word.
Exactly.
James, what's the only one-word title from the 80s?
Oh, I know this one.
Oh, good. Octopussy.
Yes, that does not count as eight. Will, how many 007 films did Joe Don Baker appear in?
At least two. I'm going to go with two.
He appeared in three. Plays Wade twice, and he was also the villain
in the Living Daylights.
Living Daylights, yes.
I think James is going to win.
Oh, well, I'm answering everybody else's questions. Mine I don't get.
You've got two out of three so far.
Jay, how many 007 films did Guy Hamilton direct?
Four.
That is correct.
Wait!
Your exasperated air really added to that answer.
Amanda, how many 007 films did Terrence Young direct?
Three?
There's a point for you.
Ding, 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 ding.
James, how many films in the series did Desmond Llewellyn appear in?
Oh my God, man. From Russia with Love, he was in Goldfinger, he was in Thunderball, he was in Vice. he was not in Live and Let Die. So, let's see.
You should be giving a margin on this one, Richard.
I was trying to keep track of the time, but every time I started doing that, somebody answered the question. I had to start over.
11.
5. 4.
3. 14, 15, 2. 16, 1. Take a shot.
17.
You got it.
Well done.
Well done.
All right. And let's see if we can be equally as obtuse. Will, how many 007 films did Lois Maxwell appear in?
Oh, hell.
Oh, my God. This is 5. 6. 14.
That is correct.
Nice.
Ding, ding, ding,
and
ding,
you did
ding.
It within 12 seconds. That's very
nice.
I think you were going to do that. All right. Jay, how many Bond film titles start with an article?
Wow.
Grammar meets film quiz. I love it.
I'm going to say 12.
It is only 5.
Oh, so close.
Oh, I know what's coming next.
Amanda.
I have no idea what's coming next.
Amanda, which actor only appeared in titles with 3 words?
That wasn't what I was thinking.
Only Bond actor, yeah. Before Jay jumps in and says, wait a second.
Timothy Dalton.
That's correct.
Thank you.
James, what's the most recent 3-word title?
Quantum of Solace.
Yes, that's a point for you. And, Will, what's the last decade with a 4-word title?
I'm going to say the 80s.
You get a point.
Oh, thank God.
Are you counting Never Say Never Again in these questions?
No. Okay, no.
Fine.
No.
Just checking.
Eon movies only.
Jay, what's the last decade with 2 3-word titles in it?
This is mean.
We knew that from the first question.
The 80s?
No, it's the 2000s.
Okay. Oh, Die Another Day, Tomorrow Never Dies. Okay.
Amanda.
Yes.
How many 2-word titles are there?
Jurassic Park, Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, Toy Story.
In the Bond series, come on. Just 007 by the numbers, Jay. Knock it off.
Look, I'm losing. I'm trying to throw people off.
I'll say 4.
Star Wars.
There are only 2.
No.
One of which was on the show today.
Yeah. Well, I knew those 2, but then I was estimating that there were 2 others that I wasn't thinking of.
James, how many titles did Lewis Gilbert direct?
You Only Live Twice, The Spy Who Loved Me, and Moonraker.
You gonna stop counting there?
3.
There you go. That's a point for you. And Will, who are the 2 Bond actors who appeared as Bond in only 1 3-word title each?
Oh, my God. All right, let's separate this out. Who are the 2 Bond
That's a graph I was never expecting to
hey,
see.
This is Will's question. Let him figure it out.
who appeared in 3-word titles.
The
2 actors who appeared in 1 film each that had 3 words in the title.
There you go.
Simple. On Fridays. in leap years.
Hey, this was tough.
You're telling us?
Questions on this.
Cut to the next one where we just do Last Time Standing, Sean Connery, go.
I'm going to answer this question. I'm going to say Pierce Brosnan, Sean Connery.
Connery and Craig. All right. And then let's see. Are we on our last question? This is 7, right?
Yes, we are.
All right. Jay, what's the greatest number of years between Bond films?
I'll give you the films.
Years, then.
Yeah, so it's
I'm shouting this at you, Jay.
Sorry?
I'm shouting this at you.
It's 87 to whenever GoldenEye came out. So
no.
It's not that. It's 89.
Are you helping him there, James?
Yes, I am.
Don't help.
I'm going to lose anyway. when did GoldenEye come out? 90-something. 6.
6, you got it. Finally.
Wait! Yes!
My luck.
Out of my ass.
Amanda.
Yes?
Who directed all 5 films in the 80s?
That I don't know. So I'm just going to say Terrence Young, even though I know that's not right.
Somebody else knows, right?
John Glenn. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Not the astronaut.
I didn't know.
James?
Yes?
According to Rotten Tomatoes, what's the highest rated Bond film?
Who cares?
that's correct. That's
Well, if that's going to be your answer, I can put that in, but that will be incorrect.
Yeah, that would be incorrect. I don't care about Rotten Tomatoes. Okay, let me take a stab at what they would think would be the best Bond film.
Is that audience or is that critical?
That's the tomato meter, so that's just critics.
Tomato meter? Okay, so they would say it would be, I'll bet you they'll think it's Casino Royale.
No. It's Goldfinger.
Okay. Oh, good.
See, now you care.
Now it matters. All right, and Will, according to Rotten Tomatoes, what is the first film in the series with a less than fresh rating?
The first film with a less than fresh rating. I'm going to say Moonraker.
That is not correct. It was The Man with the Golden Gun.
Really?
Yes.
Hmm.
So it looks to me like James won with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 out of 7.
Yep. Amanda and I had 3. Will had 2.
There you go. So was that quick enough, Jay?
That was great. Thank you, Richard. Okay. So, James, you won, so you get to plug your stuff first. What would you like to promote?
I'll send out a link to just about every Bond article I have on Blogging by CinemaLite.
Okay.
And thank you for the nomination of Once Upon a Time in the West Movie of the Month.
We'll get to that in a little bit. Amanda, what would you like to plug?
I have 2 new posts up on Hollywood Consumer. One is just my usual wrap-up for movies that I saw in January, which included Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Glass, and The Kid Who Would Be King. And then I also have a video up that's an unboxing of a James Bond novel set that I obtained recently. And I show off a couple of the other editions of the novels that I have. So those are all on Hollywood Consumer.
Very nice. Will.
Well, From Russia with Love was the 2nd film in Hollywood history to feature an exploding helicopter. But if you want to hear and learn about the first film with an exploding helicopter, then you can listen to the latest episode of the Exploding Helicopter Podcast, which is all about Behemoth the Sea Monster from 1959, which features the first film with an exploding helicopter. You can find that in all the usual podcaster places. On the website, which is explodinghelicopter.com, you can read our latest review, which is of Furious 7, which includes a review of a
fantastic exploding helicopter. I should have a review coming soon of the movie Hard Ticket to Hawaii, which, very different change of pace, but yeah. got that coming up. We've already covered it on the podcast and now covering it on the website. So that's coming soon. So, yeah, if you're interested in exploding helicopters and movies, then check out the podcast, check out the website.
And you've done a show on The Spy Who Loved Me, I think. Did you do From Russia With Love?
We haven't done From Russia With Love yet. We have done GoldenEye, which has some very interesting exploding helicopter action in it.
Yes.
It features a helicopter with an ejector seat. Who knew they existed?
Yeah, that's...
They do,
seem to be problematic.
They do within the James Bond universe. Yeah. So, yeah. We haven't yet fully exploited the James Bond universe for either the podcast or the website, but we're getting there.
Well, if you're looking for guests, I've got a long list of people who want to talk about Bond films. four more on this show. Richard, anything to promote?
I don't have anything new, except I would remind people to go over to Acting School 101, which is in their Lambcast feed, and listen to Movie Rob and I talk about Laura Dern. She was the Actor of the Month this month. And then just since we're on this, if you go back a few years to October of 2015, as we were leading up to Spectre, I did a post on every Bond film, my 007 favorite things from each film. So that's October of 2015, if anybody's interested.
Okay. As for me, I haven't got anything new over at my site, Life as a Film, but you can still read my January wrap-up of all the films that I watched and all the resolution targets and things for January, and also my review of Roma, which I still don't recommend. And
why not?
Because
it's not good.
It's amazing.
It's not, though. If it wins, okay, more on that later. But I will instead. Last week's show was on Tombstone, our movie of the month. So this past week, I've started listening to Tombstone Minute, the film that looks at Tombstone 1 minute at a time, and I've been enjoying it immensely, so I can recommend that instead. Over on the Lamb site, Lamb scores went up on Friday for Glass, which we've talked about on this show in the past, and quite a range of reviews submitted for Glass all over the place, really. Director of the Month was Penny Marshall. That has been posted up on the Lamb site. I don't know who Tony has picked for the next month, so come out next week to find out who that is. But our actor is still Laura Dern, so if you have any reviews, features, or podcasts on any Laura Dern film, you could submit those, and they'll be posted next week, I think. Every day on the Lamb site between now and the Oscar ceremony, which is in just 2 weeks' time at this point, we will be posting a coverage of a different Oscar category or a Best Picture nominee. Movie Rob is heading up that one, so you've got a bunch of different Best Picture nominees and categories been added this past week. So head over to the Lamb site to see what's going on there. And whilst you're there, you can vote for March's Movie of the Month. There are 8 films that have been submitted for you to pick between for what we're going to talk about next month. And those 8 are... Howard Kasner from Rantings and Ravings has submitted Laura from 1944. Troy Anderson from Anderson Vision has submitted Forbidden Zone from 1980, starring Hervé Villechaize of The Man with the Golden Gun. David Brook, Blueprint Review, has put forward Evil Dead 2. Sean Homrick from the 1001 Movies podcast has put forward Heat. Joel Berman, former Shepherd of the Lamb, has put forward Martha Girl from 2012. I hadn't heard of it. Probably not going to be talking about it, if I'm honest, looking at the poll. And Tony Kogan of Coogs Review has put forward Paddington, the first Paddington. But two of our guests, they have submitted films as well. So James, you've put forward Once Upon a Time in the West. Why should people vote for that?
I think it's the best Sergio Leone film, and it is just a masterclass on how to make a compelling movie with stillness.
Okay. And Amanda, you submitted Silverado. Why should people vote for that?
Well, it's my second favorite film of all time. It's a great Western. It's got a lot of great performances, and I absolutely love it. My dog is named after one of the characters, and I think it's just a good kind of buddy Western, a little bit of a revival in the 80s of what Westerns were supposed to be. And yeah, so I think it's a lot of fun. I think people should vote for it.
And one of the best Western scripts written.
Yes. And a great score, too.
Oh, the score is magnificent.
Yeah.
Well done. So whichever one of those eight films you think we should talk about next month, go head over to largeassmovieblogs.com and make your pick. It's currently not going how I expected. But I don't mind the direction it's taken. But that will do it for today's show. Next week is our Oscar predictions show. I'm afraid I will not be on next week's show. Busy weekend for me. But Richard will be taking the chair, or Richard and Movie Rob will be combined taking the hosting duties. Looking at what they and we and everyone thinks is going to win the Oscars this year. So come back next year for that one if you've got an Oscar draft to fill out. But as for today's show, I'd like to thank, in no particular order, James Wilson from Blogging by Cinemalight.
Thank you.
Also thank you to Will Slater from Exploding Helicopter.
My dear girl, there are just some things that just aren't done, such as listening to this podcast without earmuffs.
Thanks, Will. Also thanks to Amanda Kirkham from Hollywood Consumer.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Richard Kirkham from Kirkham and Movie A Day.
I never joke about my work, 007. All right.
I need to just take a minute to run off and have a water PPK.
Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Oh no. Go to hell. Go to hell. Heaven, goats go to hell.
You've been listening to the Lambcast. If you've got an idea for a show, any improvements we can make, or you'd like to be a guest on an upcoming episode, find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on Twitter, at Lambcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com, and please head over to iTunes to leave us a review. The Lambcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.